Mongols proved as worthy competitors in commerce as the Mongols had been in conquest, and they began to dominate trade on the Indian Ocean. To expand the trade into new areas beyond Mongol political control, they encouraged some of their vassals, particularly the South Chinese, to emigrate and set up trading stations in foreign ports. Throughout the rule of the Mongol dynasty, thousands of Chinese left home and sailed off to settle along the coastal communities of Vietnam, Cambodia, the Malay Peninsula, Borneo, Java, and Sumatra. They worked mostly in shipping and trade, and as merchants up and down the rivers leading to the ports, but they gradually expanded into other professions as well. To reach the markets of Europe more directly, without the lengthy detour through the southern Muslim countries, the Mongols encouraged foreigners to create trading posts on the edges of the empire along the Black Sea. Although the Mongols had initially raided the trading posts as early as 1226 during the reign of Genghis Khan, they allowed the Genoese to maintain a trading station at the port of Kaffa in the Crimea, and later added another at Tana. To protect these stations on land and sea, the Mongols hunted down pirates and robbers. In the Pratica de la Mercatura, Practice of Marketing, a commercial handbook published in 1340, the Florentine merchant Francesco Balducci Pegolotti stressed that the routes to Mongol Cathay were perfectly safe, whether by day or by night. The opening of new trade routes, combined with the widespread destruction of manufacturing in Persia and Iraq by the Mongol invasions, created new opportunities for Chinese manufacturing. The Mongol conquest of China had been far less disruptive than the military campaigns in the Middle East. And Kublai pressed for the expansion of traditional Chinese wares into these markets, as well as the widespread transfer of Muslim and Indian technology to China. Through their shares, the members of the Mongol royal family controlled much of the production throughout Eurasia. But they depended on the merchant class to transport and sell these wares. Mongols had turned from warriors into shareholders, but they had no skill or apparent desire to become merchants themselves. The Mongol elite's intimate involvement with trade represented a marked break with tradition. From China to Europe, traditional aristocrats generally disdained commercial enterprise as undignified, dirty, and often immoral. It ranked with the manual trades, beneath the interests of either the powerful or the pious. Furthermore, the economic ideal in feudal Europe of this time was not merely that each country should be self-sufficient, but that each man or estate should strive to be as self-supporting as practical. Any goods that left the estate should not be going to trade for other goods for the peasants on the land, but to buy jewelry, religious relics, and other luxury goods for the aristocratic family or church. The feudal rulers sought to have their peasants supply all their own needs, to produce their food, grow their timber, make their tools and weave their cloth, and to trade for as little as possible. In a feudal system, reliance on imported goods represented a failure at home. The traditional Chinese kingdoms operated under centuries of constraints on commerce. The building of walls on their borders had been a way of limiting such trade, and literally keeping the wealth of the nation intact and inside the walls. For such administrators, giving up trade goods was the same as paying tribute to their neighbors, and they sought to avoid it as much as they could. The Mongols directly attacked the Chinese cultural prejudice that ranked merchants as merely a step above robbers by officially elevating their status ahead of all religions and professions, second only to government officials. In a further degradation of Confucian scholars, the Mongols reduced them from the highest level of traditional Chinese society to the ninth level, just below prostitutes, but above beggars. Since the time of Genghis Khan, the Mongols realized that items that were commonplace and taken for granted in one place were exotic and potentially marketable in another. The latter decades of the 13th century became a time of nearly frenetic search for new commodities that could be marketed somewhere in the expanding network of Mongol commerce, or for old commodities that could be marketed in a new way. It must have seemed that every item, from dyes, paper, and drugs, to pistachios, firecrackers, and poison, had a potential buyer. And the Mongol officials seemed determined to find who and where that buyer might be. By responding to the needs of a universal market, the Mongol workshops in China eventually were producing not merely traditional Chinese crafts of porcelains and silks for the world market, but adding entirely new items for specialized markets, including the manufacture of images of the Madonna and the Christ Child, carved in ivory and exported to Europe. The Mongol promotion of trade introduced a variety of new fabrics by taking local products and finding an international market for them. The origins of such textiles can still be seen in the etymology of many of their names. A particularly smooth and glossy type of silk became known in the West as satin, taking its name from the Mongol port of Zeytun, from which Marco Polo sailed on his return to Europe. A style of highly ornate cloth became known as damask silk, derived from the name of Damascus, the city through which most of the trade from the Ilkhanate of Persia passed en route to Europe. Marco Polo mentioned another type of fine, delicate cloth made in Mosul, and it became known as mouslon in Old French, and then as muslin in English. Even the most trivial items might yield a great profit, as when the newcomers sparked a rapid spread of card playing because merchants and soldiers found the light and easily transported game an entertaining and novel pastime. Compared to the more cumbersome objects needed for chess and other board games, any soldier or camel driver could carry a pack of cards in his gear. The new market stimulated the need to make card production faster and cheaper, and the solution for that process was found in printing them from carved blocks, normally used for printing religious scripture. The market for printed cards proved much greater than that for scripture. Most empires of conquest in history have imposed their own civilization on the conquered. The Romans imposed the Latin language, their gods, and a preference for wine, olive oil, and wheat agriculture even in locales where it did not thrive. Each Roman city from Ephesus in Turkey to Cologne in Germany had the same urban design and architectural style. From markets and baths all the way to the smallest details on the columns or doorways. In other eras, the British erected Tudor buildings in Bombay. The Dutch built windmills in the Caribbean. The Spaniards constructed their own style of cathedrals and plazas from Mexico to Argentina. And Americans erected their distinctive residential compounds from Panama to Saudi Arabia. Merely by studying the physical remains of a place, archaeologists can trace the growth of Hindu, Aztec, Malian, Incan, or Arab empires. By comparison, the Mongols trod lightly on the world they conquered. They brought no distinctive architectural style with them, nor did they seek to impose their language and religion on the conquered, since in most cases they forbade non-Mongols to learn their language. The Mongols did not force cultivation of an alien crop, nor impose radical change on their subjects' collective way of life. Skilled at moving large numbers of people and utilizing new technology for purposes of war, the Mongols continued the same practices during the Mongol peace and applied itinerant principles of the nomadic society to very conservative areas of life and culture. The Mongol armies rounded up translators, scribes, doctors, astronomers, and mathematicians to be parceled out among the families in the same shares that they parceled out musicians, cooks, goldsmiths, acrobats, and painters. The authorities divided these knowledge workers together with all the other craftsmen, the animals, and other goods for transportation via a long caravan trek or sea journey to the various parts of the family. Traditional empires accumulated wealth in a single city. All routes led to the capital city, and the best of everything ended up there. One place so dominated such empires that the name of cities like Rome or Babylon became the names of the empires themselves. The Mongol Empire never had a single major city, and within the empire, goods and people constantly traveled from one place to another. In 1261, Kublai Khan created the Office for the Stimulation of Agriculture, under the authority of 8 commissioners who sought ways to improve farmers' lives and their yields. In addition to improving crop cultivation, the office bore responsibility to generally protect and promote the well-being of the peasants. This policy toward farmers constituted a substantial attitudinal shift on the part of a government that preserved the attitudes derived from the Mongols' traditional nomadic lifestyle and had traditionally shown limited concern for the peasantry and for agricultural problems. Prior to the Mongol occupation of China, most farmers within any area cultivated the same set of crops. The crops varied by region, but not within a region. The Mongols encouraged farmers to cultivate those crops that proved most appropriate for the climate, soil type, and drainage pattern. This change in emphasis promoted greater variety within an area and higher productivity. Mongol authorities encouraged the spread of traditional Chinese crops, such as tea and rice, into new areas, particularly into Persia and the Middle East. The Mongols sought better tools and thus spread the use of an improved triangular plow introduced into China from Southeast Asia. As soon as the Mongols assumed control of Persia, they established an office to encourage and improve agriculture there. After thousands of years of cultivation, the soils of the area had been eroded and productivity threatened. The Mongols addressed these problems with extensive importation of seeds from China, and when needed, shoots, branches, and whole trees that they planted in newly created agricultural stations for adaptation to Middle Eastern climate and soil. They brought new varieties of rice and millet, as well as fruit trees and root crops. India, China, and Persia cultivated some variety of citrus fruits before the Mongols, but the Mongols assiduously moved and mixed the varieties so that each region had more types. Near Canton in southern China, the Mongol authorities planted an orchard of 800 lemon trees imported from their territories in the Middle East. At Tabriz in Persia, the Mongols similarly planted groves of a different variety of lemon and other citrus trees imported in the opposite direction, from China to the Middle East. The Mongols transplanted an ever-expanding variety of peas, beans, grapes, lentils, nuts, carrots, turnips, melons, and diverse leaf vegetables, and in turn, they developed new varieties and hybrids. In addition to food crops for humans and animals, Mongol authorities had a persistent interest in varieties of cotton and other crops for making textiles, as well as various materials for making rope, dyes, oils, ink, paper, and medicine. Because of the lucrative textile trade and its prominence in generating foreign trade, the Mongol rulers maintained a particular interest in the varieties of wool that they produced from their herds, as well as in the silks, cottons, and other fibers produced by farmers. To promote cotton cultivation, they created a cotton promotion bureau in 1289 and dispersed representatives throughout the newly conquered provinces of the southeast coast and along the Yangtze. The Bureau devised methods for growing cotton farther north in the wheat areas and promoted better weaving and manufacturing techniques. Although silk maintained higher prestige, both within and beyond China, cotton proved to be a valuable new fiber crop. Each innovation in one area brought the likelihood of many other changes. New crops required new styles of plowing, planting, irrigation, pruning, staking, harvesting, cutting, threshing, grinding, transporting, preserving, brewing, distilling, and cooking. The new or slightly altered techniques required the use of new tools and implements, which, in turn, needed new techniques of manufacture. The Mongols made culture portable. It was not enough to merely exchange goods, because whole systems of knowledge had to also be transported in order to use many of the new products. Drugs, for example, were not profitable items of trade unless there was adequate knowledge of how to use them. Toward this objective, the Mongol court imported Persian and Arab doctors into China, and they exported Chinese doctors to the Middle East. Every form of knowledge carried new possibilities for merchandising. It became apparent that the Chinese operated with a superior knowledge of pharmacology and of unusual forms of treatment such as acupuncture, the insertion of needles at key points in the body, and moxibustion, the application of fire or heat to similar areas. Muslim doctors, however, possessed a much more sophisticated knowledge of surgery. But based on their dissection of executed criminals, the Chinese had a detailed knowledge of internal organs and the circulatory system. To encourage a fuller exchange of medical knowledge, the Mongols created hospitals and training centers in China using doctors from India and the Middle East, as well as Chinese healers. Kublai Khan founded a department for the study of Western medicine under the direction of a Christian scholar. The Mongols established a house of healing near Tabriz to serve as a combination hospital, research center, and training facility in the medical knowledge of both East and West. In Mongol-occupied Persia in 1313, Rashid al-Din published the first known book on Chinese medicine to be published outside of China, including illustrations actually made in China. Chinese acupuncture did not prove popular in the Middle East because it required, according to Muslim values, too much physical contact and manipulation in placing the needles around the body. On the other hand, the Chinese practice of pulse diagnosis proved very popular in the Middle East and India with Muslims because it merely required the physician to touch the patient's wrist before rendering a diagnosis and prescribing treatment. Using this novel method, doctors could treat female patients without violating the honor of her family. Only a few years after uniting China under his rule, Kublai created the Academy for Calendrical Studies and a printing office to mass-produce a variety of calendars and almanacs. If a ruler had the mandate of heaven to rule over his people, then he had to display an ability to mark time, to forecast the phases of the moon, the changing of seasons, and, possibly most important for public prestige and opinion, the timing of lunar and solar eclipses. The Mongol rulers, however, faced a much larger problem with their calendar. In a traditional empire with a single court and capital, a single official calendar sufficed, and it mattered little that other nations kept other calendars. In the multi-headed Mongol Empire, capitals were scattered across great distances, and it became important to coordinate them in order to manage the movement of the large armies and massive amounts of goods. East Asians utilized a 12-year animal cycle, while Muslims used a moon calendar of progressive years beginning with the foundation of their religion. Persians marked the beginning of the year by the equinox of the sun. Some events were marked by the movement of planets, particularly Mars and Venus, or by the stars. Europeans used a solar calendar, except for religious celebrations such as Lent, Easter, and Epiphany, that were calculated on the lunar calendar. Even the Christian sects disagreed on the timing of these events, with the result that, despite constant adjustments, their calendars failed to coincide. As the Mongol Empire of Conquest expanded into an even larger empire of commerce, it became increasingly important for the Mongols to have a smoothly functioning calendar that operated according to the same principles throughout the empire. With the need to coordinate activities and regulate social life in places with such varied ways of marking time, the Mongols, almost as soon as they conquered an area, created observatories to accurately measure the movement of planets and stars for both practical and religious reasons. They built one immediately near Tabriz. But China needed a series of observatories erected across the land because it was so large. Mongol authorities had specific instructions from the central government to seek out astronomers and astronomical instruments and charts in each newly conquered land. Huleg sent many of the astronomers captured in the Persian and Arab cities back to his homeland in Mongolia. These included Jamal ad-Din, who was one of the most brilliant astronomers of the era. He brought with him the blueprints for major astronomical devices and new means of scientific measurement unknown in China. On a scale that surpassed prior civilizations, the Mongols needed to process and record massive amounts of numerical information in the censuses of people, animals, and buildings. Each year, they had to settle the accounts for all the goods sent back and forth, as well as for the movement of herds, soldiers, and merchants. The new forms of agriculture, the demands of astronomy, the system of censuses, and myriad other issues of administration taxed the numerical knowledge and ability of the area. They necessitated new approaches to the handling of numbers. To make the needed calculations quickly and efficiently, the clerks working for the Mongols relied on the abacus, which, with the movement of a few beads, allowed them to calculate large sums mechanically with less mental effort than making the calculations mentally or through writing. Always fastidious about numerical information, and with hundreds of millions of people across the vast Mongol Empire, the Mongols searched for simpler methods, shortcuts, and ways of calculating ever larger quantities and processing them in ever more complex sequences. The larger numbers of calculations required new ways of preserving information through the compilation of complex charts and the coordination of the number systems used in different countries. Mongol administrators found both European and Chinese mathematics too simple and impractical, but they adopted many useful innovations from Arabic and Indian mathematics. The cities of the Khwarizm Empire had been a particularly important center for mathematics scholarship. The word algorithm was derived from Al-Khwarizm. The Mongols transported knowledge of these innovations throughout their empire. They quickly discerned the advantages of utilizing columns of numbers or place numbers in the style of Arabic numerals, and they introduced the use of zero, negative numbers, and algebra in China. Not just in numbers and calendars, but on many levels, life itself, in various parts of the empire, had to be coordinated in a way that prior history had not required. The writing of history proved too important to allow each civilization to proceed in its own manner, and according to the conventions developed in their literary traditions. To control the way that they themselves were presented to their subjects, the Mongols had to make the local standards on writing history correlate and articulate with the Mongol story. Written history was much more than a means of recording information. It served as a tool to legitimize the ruling dynasty and spread propaganda about its great conquests and achievements. For the Mongols, written history also became an important tool in learning about other nations in order to conquer and rule them more effectively. Kublai Khan established the National History Office in the 1260s. In keeping with Chinese practices, he commissioned the compilation of complete histories of the Jurchid and Khitan kingdoms, as well as the Song dynasty. The project was probably the most massive history project ever commissioned, and took nearly 80 years until the 1340s to complete. In Mongol Persia, the Ilkhan Ghazan commissioned the first history of the world from Rashid al-Din, a successor of Juveini. Rashid al-Din orchestrated a massive undertaking that employed many different scholars and translators in order to create histories of the Chinese, Turks, and Franks, as the Mongols called the Europeans. The volume of information produced in the Mongol Empire required new forms of dissemination. Scribes could no longer handle the flow by laboriously hand-copying everything that needed to be written. They compiled the records, wrote letters, and sent information to those who needed it. But they did not have time to copy agricultural manuals, medical treatises, atlases, and astronomical tables. Information had to be mass-produced for mass dissemination. And for this task, the Mongols turned again to technology, to printing. The Mongols adopted printing technology very early. In addition to the printings sponsored by Torajin during the reign of her husband, beginning in 1236, Ogedei ordered the establishment of a series of regional printing facilities across the Mongol-controlled territory of northern China. Printing with movable letters probably began in China in the middle of the 12th century, but it was the Mongols who employed it on a massive scale and harnessed its potential power to the needs of state administration. Instead of the printing with thousands of characters, as the Chinese did, the Mongols used an alphabet in which the same letters were used repeatedly. Under the Mongols, printers carved out many copies of each letter that could then be arranged into whatever word was needed. Each time the printer wanted a new page of print, instead of carving the whole text, he needed to merely place the right sequence of already carved letters into position, use them, and then wait until the next printing job, when they would be rearranged and then used again. General literacy increased during the Mongol dynasty, and the volume of literary material grew proportionately. In 1269, Kublai Khan established a printing office to make government decisions more widely disseminated throughout the population, and he encouraged widespread printing in general by non-governmental groups as well. This included religious books and novels, in addition to government publications. The number of books in print increased so dramatically that their price fell constantly throughout the era of Mongol rule. Presses throughout the Mongol Empire were soon printing agriculture pamphlets, almanacs, scriptures, laws, histories, medical treatises, new mathematical theories, songs, and poetry in many different languages. Whether in their policy of religious tolerance, devising a universal alphabet, maintaining relay stations, playing games, or printing almanacs, money, or astronomy charts, the rulers of the Mongol Empire displayed a persistent universalism. Because they had no system of their own to impose upon their subjects, they were willing to adopt and combine systems from everywhere. Without deep cultural preferences in these areas, the Mongols implemented pragmatic rather than ideological solutions. They searched for what worked best, and when they found it, they spread it to other countries. They did not have to worry whether their astronomy agreed with the precepts of the Bible, that their standards of writing followed the classical principles taught by the mandarins of China, or that Muslim imams disapproved of their printing and painting. The Mongols had the power, at least temporarily, to impose new international systems of technology, agriculture, and knowledge that superseded the predilections or prejudices of any single civilization. and in so doing, they broke the monopoly on thought exercised by local elites. In conquering their empire, not only had the Mongols revolutionized warfare, they also created the nucleus of the universal culture and world system. This new global culture continued to grow long after the demise of the Mongol Empire. And through continued development over the coming centuries, it became the foundation for the modern world system, with the original Mongol emphases on free commerce, open communication, shared knowledge, secular politics, religious coexistence, international law, and diplomatic immunity. Although never ruled by the Mongols, in many ways Europe gained the most from their world system. The Europeans received all the benefits of trade, technology transfer, and the global awakening without paying the cost of Mongol conquest. The Mongols had killed off the knights in Hungary and Germany, but they had not destroyed or occupied the cities. The Europeans, who had been cut off from the mainstream of civilization since the fall of Rome, eagerly drank in the new knowledge, put on the new clothes, listened to the new music, ate the new foods, and enjoyed a rapidly escalating standard of living in almost every regard. The Europeans easily forgot the historical commentary of chroniclers such as Matthew Paris and Thomas of Spalato, who wrote about the Mongol invasions back in 1240. Across the intervening century, the Mongols had come to represent sumptuous trade goods and luxurious rarities to the Europeans. The word Tartar no longer signified unbridled terror. Instead, the Italian writers Dante and Boccaccio and the English writer Chaucer used the phrase pani tartarici, Tartar cloth or Tartar satin, as terms for the finest cloth in the world. When King Edward III of England ordered 150 garters to be made for his Knights of the Garters, he specified that they be in Tartar blue. Such terms obviously did not apply to textiles or dyes made by the Mongols, but to ones traded by them or originating in their territory. One technological innovation after another arrived in Europe. The most labor-intensive professions, such as mining, milling, and metalwork, had depended almost entirely on human and animal labor. But they quickly became more mechanized with the harnessing of water and wind power. The transmission of the technology for improving the blast furnace also arrived in Europe from Asia via the Mongol trade routes, and it allowed metal workers to achieve higher temperatures and thereby improve the quality of metal, an increasingly important material in this new high-technology era. In Europe, as a result of the Mongol global awakening, carpenters used the general adze less and adapted more specialized tools for specific functions to make their work faster and more efficient. Builders used new types of cranes and hoists. There was a quick spread of new crops that required less work to produce, or less processing after production. Carrots, turnips, cress, buckwheat, and parsnips became common parts of the diet. Labor-intensive cooking was improved by mechanizing the meat spit to be turned more easily. The new tools, machines, and mechanical devices helped to build everything, from ships and docks to warehouses and canals, faster and better, just as, previously, the improved Mongol technology of war helped to tear down and destroy quicker with improved cannons and firepower. Something as simple as preparing a single-page document on vellum or parchment required the labor of a long line of skilled workers. Aside from the herder who raised the sheep, the slaughtering and skinning were so important to make quality writing material that it required a skilled craft of skinners. Over several weeks, the skin had to be cleaned and scraped of hair on the outside and flesh on the inside, soaked in a sequence of chemical baths, stretched on a frequently readjusted frame, sunned, alternately wet and dried in a precise sequence, shaved, and finally cut into pages of the appropriate size. To make the pages into a book, a whole new sequence of trades were drawn on to make the ink, copy the text, illustrate it, color it, and bind it with leather that had already been through its own sequence of workshops. The replacement of parchment by paper, a Chinese innovation, already known but only rarely used in Europe prior to the Mongol era, required more skill in one worker, but far fewer steps, and thus, in the overall process, less energy and labor. The papermaker cooked down shredded rags and other fibrous materials, dipped a frame into the vat to coat it with a layer of the fibers, treated it with chemicals, and dried it. The increased demand for paper arose with the spread of printing. One of the most laborious tasks in medieval society had been the copying of manuscripts and documents, all of which had been done by hand in monasteries that functioned as book factories, with scribes carefully copying all day in a large scriptorium. Aside from the cost of their meager food and basic upkeep, the labor was free, and the money earned from the sale went to other uses within the church. Johannes Gutenberg completed the adaptation with his production of 200 Bibles in 1455, and started the printing and information revolution in the West. The new technology made the relatively minor trade of bookmaking into one of the most potent forces of public life. It stimulated the revival of Greek classics, the development of written forms of the vernacular languages, the growth of nationalism, the outbreak of the Protestant Reformation, the birth of science, and virtually every aspect of life and learning, from agronomy to zoology. The ideas of the Mongol Empire awakened new possibilities in the European mind. New knowledge, from the travel writings of Marco Polo to the detailed star charts of Ulugh Beg, proved that much of their received classical knowledge was simply wrong, and at the same time it opened up new paths of intellectual discovery. Because much of the Mongol Empire had been based on novel ideas and ways of organizing public life rather than on mere technology, these ideas provoked new thoughts and experiments in Europe. The common principles of the Mongol Empire, such as paper money, primacy of the state over the church, freedom of religion, diplomatic immunity, and international law, were ideas that gained new importance. As early as 1620, the English scientist Francis Bacon recognized the impact that changing technology had produced in Europe. He designated printing, gunpowder, and the compass as three technological innovations on which the modern world was built. Although they were unknown to the ancients, these three have changed the appearance and state of the whole world, first in literature, then in warfare, and lastly in navigation. More important than the innovations themselves, from them, innumerable changes have been thence derived. In a clear recognition of their importance, he wrote that no empire, sect, or star appears to have exercised a greater power and influence on human affairs than these mechanical discoveries. All of them had been spread to the West during the era of the Mongol Empire. Under the widespread influences from the paper and printing, gunpowder and firearms, and the spread of the navigational compass and other maritime equipment, Europeans experienced a renaissance, literally a rebirth. But it was not the ancient world of Greece and Rome being reborn. It was the Mongol Empire, picked up, transferred, and adapted by the Europeans to their own needs and culture. In May 1288, soon after meeting with Rabban Bar Sauma, and receiving a letter and gifts from the Mongol court, Pope Nicholas IV issued a papal bull calling for construction of a new mother church at Assisi for his Franciscan order. As the first Franciscan pope, Nicholas IV together with his fellow Franciscans, seemingly wanted to proclaim the coming of age of their order. For this project, they wanted imagery that not only proclaimed their new status, but highlighted the accomplishments of the order. The Franciscans had the closest ties of any Europe group to the Mongol court. Among others, the monks in the delegation of Plano di Carpini, who had served as the first envoy to the Mongols at the time of Guyuk's election as Great Khan, and William of Rubruck, who visited in the time of Monk Khan's installation, had all been Franciscans. The artists borrowed themes and techniques from the Chinese and Persian art brought in by the Mongols, quite possibly from the gifts brought by Rabban Bar Sauma himself. The paintings shared a common source in the work of Giotto di Bondone and his disciples, and they seemed to radiate from a set of paintings in the Franciscan monastery at Assisi. Although the frescoes of the church depicted events from the life of Christ, more than 1,000 years before the Mongol Empire, or the life of St. Francis, only shortly before the Mongol contact, the artists depicted many of their subjects as Mongols, or used Mongol dress and cloth for them. In the fresco cycle, St. Francis's life is literally wrapped in silk. Almost every scene depicts painted and figured textiles, either defining the stories or draped below in imaginary swaths. In addition to simple silks, they portray the elaborate brocades that the Mongols liked and sent to the Pope and kings as gifts. The artists placed Mongols in a variety of Christian paintings, with their distinctive clothing, headgear, and bows. Horses began to appear in the art in the style of Chinese drawings, made popular through Mongol commerce. The pictures also showed a strong Asian influence in the depiction of rocky crags and trees. European art, which had been flat and unidimensional throughout the Middle Ages, produced a new hybrid that was neither strictly European nor strictly Asian. It was a style of depth, light, textiles, and horses that became later known as Renaissance art. By themselves, the images probably represented no more than a new awareness by the artists of the variety of human faces in the world. But in a 1306 illustration of the robe of Christ in Padua, the robe not only was made in the style and fabric of the Mongols, but the golden trim was painted in Mongol letters from the square Pogpa script commissioned by Kublai Khan. In the same church, the vice of infidelity appeared as a woman wearing the pith helmet-style hat favored by Kublai Khan. Old Testament prophets were depicted holding scrolls open to long but undecipherable text in Mongol script. The direct allusions to the writing and clothing from the court of Kublai Khan showed an undeniable connection between Italian Renaissance art and the Mongol Empire. In the same way that Mongol faces and script began to appear in the art of Renaissance Europe, the Mongol ideas also began to show up in the literary and philosophical works of the era. The provocative nature of Mongol ideas and policies appeared decisively in the work of the German cleric Nicolaus of Cusa, whose 1440 essay, On Learned Ignorance, might be considered as the opening of the European Renaissance. He had spent time on church business in Constantinople shortly before its fall to the Ottomans, and, as his subsequent writings revealed, he was well acquainted with the ideas of the Persian, Arab, and Mongol civilizations. In 1453, he wrote a long essay on the Peace of Faith, in which he presented imaginary dialogues among representatives of 17 nations and religions concerning the best way to promote global peace and understanding. The author shows some more than superficial awareness of Mongol religious ideology when he quotes the Tatar representative as describing his nation as a numerous and simple people who worship the one God above others, are astounded over the variety of rites which others have, who worship one and the same God with them. They deride the custom by which some Christians, all Arabs and Jews, are circumcised, that others are marked on their brows with a brand, others are baptized. He also notes the Mongol puzzlement at Christian ritual and theology, in particular, that among these various forms of sacrifice, there is the Christian sacrifice, in which they offer bread and wine and say it is the body and blood of Christ. That they eat and drink the sacrifice after the oblations seems most abominable. They devour what they worship. The fictional Tatar in the debate echoed precisely the words of Monk Khan to the French envoy when he denounced the pernicious enmity among the religions of the world. It is proper to keep the commandments of God. But the Jews say they have received these commandments from Moses. The Arabs say they have them from Muhammad, and the Christians from Jesus. And there are perhaps other nations who honor their prophets, through whose hands they assert they have received the divine precepts. Therefore, how shall we arrive at concord? The Mongol answer had been that simple religious concord could only be produced by subsuming all religions under the power of the state. The visit of Mongol envoys such as Rabban Bar Sauma furnished the Europeans with a far different view of the distant and exotic Mongols. No longer feeling a threat from the Mongols, Europeans began to see in Genghis Khan's empire an intriguing alternative to the society in which they lived. Whereas writers used the Muslims to represent everything that the Europeans despised, they saturated the Mongol story with romantic images of a much better world, which in some ways was considered a utopia, the ideal society. The imagery of Mongol greatness received its clearest statement around 1390 by Geoffrey Chaucer, who had traveled widely in France and Italy on diplomatic business, and had a far more international perspective than many of the people for whom he wrote. In the Canterbury Tales, the first book written in English, the story of the squire relates a romantic and fanciful tale about the life and adventures of Genghis Khan. This noble king was called Genghis Khan, who in his time was of so great renown that there was nowhere in no region so excellent a lord in all things. He lacked nothing that belonged to a king. As of the sect of which he was born, he kept his law, to which that he was sworn. And thereto he was hardy, wise, and rich, and piteous and just, always liked. Soothe of his word, benign and honorable, of his courage as any center stable. Young, fresh, and strong, in arms desirous, as any bachelor of all his house. A fair person he was, and fortunate, and kept always so well royal estate that there was nowhere such another man. This noble king, this Tartar, Genghis Khan. Chapter 10. The Empire of Illusion. When Christopher Columbus set sail from Spain in 1492, he was heading for Cathay, the land of the great Khan. David Morgan. In 1332, confusion, alarm, and pain ran amok in the pleasure palaces of Xanadu, the Mongol summer capital of Chengdu. The royal family remained there well past the end of summer, and despite efforts to keep the crisis secret, it became apparent that the Mongol rulers were in a turmoil so deep that it threatened continuation of the dynasty. The surviving information offers muddled accounts of what was happening, but it appears that the office of the Great Khan bounced from brother to brother and from father to son in a flurry of assassinations, disappearances, and inexplicable deaths. From 1328 to 1332, at least four members of the Golden Family occupied the throne, and one, The 7-year-old Rinchibal Khan had it for only 2 months in 1332. Fear gripped everyone. In the household, everyone from the young to the old, from the lowest servant to the great Khan, seemed in danger of dying a horrible death. Nearly as much turmoil and confusion churned outside the capital as inside. But it was neither foreign invaders nor rebels that threatened the society. The fear arose from something far more sinister and mysterious, but with quite visible effects everywhere. The plague. A person could appear healthy in the morning, but suddenly break into hot fever that rapidly gave way to chills, accompanied by both vomiting and diarrhea. The bodies of individuals who had only a short time earlier appeared active and robust suddenly and inexplicably broke down and began to dissolve before the horrified family observers. Blood began to ooze beneath the skin, which discolored the skin. Lumps formed and oozed blood and pus in the groin. The lumps, subsequently called bubos, from the Greek word for groin, then formed in the armpit and neck, and from them came the medical term for the disease, bubonic plague. When the lumps grew too large, they burst open. The lack of oxygen moving into the body and the dried blood beneath the skin made the person appear to turn black. From this dramatic symptom, the disease became known as the Black Death. After only a few agonizing days of tortured pain, the person usually died. In some victims, the disease attacked the lungs rather than the lymph nodes, and as the air in the lungs turned bloody and frothy, they drowned. As they died, they infected those around them by violent coughing, sneezing, and gasping. According to the most plausible but not completely verifiable accounts, the disease originated in the south of China, and Mongol warriors brought it north with them. The plague bacterium lives in fleas, which traveled on rats transported in shipments of food or other tribute taken from the south. Although the fleas do not normally infect humans, and the smell of horses repels them, they can live in sacks of grain, human clothing, and other places in the vicinity of humans, while awaiting their chance to jump on them. Once the infected fleas arrived in the Gobi, they easily found hospitable new homes in marmot burrows and the extensive rodent colonies, where they have lived ever since. On the open steppe of Mongolia, the plague remained just as virulent, but it posed less danger in the sparsely inhabited environment. Even today, it kills a handful of victims every year in the summer. But the small population living among so many horses and the lack of fleas in the Mongol dwellings tend to keep the disease from becoming an epidemic. By contrast, in the densely inhabited urban areas of China, and later in other urban areas, the disease found its perfect environment in the rat populations that had lived in close proximity with humans for so long that no one suspected them as sources for the disease. In 1331, chroniclers recorded that 90% of the people of Hopei province died. By 1351, China had reportedly lost between one-half and two-thirds of its population to the plague. The country had included some 123 million inhabitants at the beginning of the 13th century. But by the end of the 14th century, the population dropped to as low as 65 million. China functioned as the manufacturing center of the Mongol world system. And as the goods poured out of China, the disease followed, seemingly spreading in all directions at once. Archaeological evidence of graves near trading posts indicates that by 1338, the plague crossed from China over the Tian Shan Mountains and wiped out a Christian trading community near Lake Issyk-Kul in Kyrgyzstan. the plague was an epidemic of commerce. The same Mongol roads and caravans that knitted together the Eurasian world of the 13th and 14th centuries moved more than mere silk and spices. The roads and way stations set up by the Mongols for merchants also served as the inadvertent transfer points for the fleas, and thereby for the disease itself. With the luxurious fabrics, exotic flavors, and opulent jewels, the caravans brought the fleas that spread the plague from one camp to another, one village to another, one city to another, and one continent to another. If plague destroyed only a single crucial station in a mountain pass, or blocked one route through the desert, it potentially isolated a large region within the vast empire. Plague reached the capital of the Golden Horde at Sare on the lower Volga in 1345. At this time, Yanabek, the Kipchak Khan, was preparing to lay siege to the Crimean port of Kaffa, modern-day Feodosia in Ukraine, a trading post established by merchants from Genoa, primarily for the export of Russian slaves to Egypt. The Mongols had sometimes cooperated with the Italian slave merchants, and at other times tried to suppress their trade. The Mongol authorities had closed the trading post and expelled the Genovese on several occasions. But each time, they would eventually relent and allow them to return. To protect themselves from further Mongol threats, and to safeguard their transit in slaves, the Genoese built a strong protective wall around their city, and a second inner wall to protect the heart of the trading post. When plague broke out in the Mongol army, it forced Yanabek to lift the siege and retreat. But the disease readily spread from the Mongol camp to the adjacent port. According to a single European report, Yanabek had the bodies of plague victims catapulted over the walls and into the city. And though the Genovese tried to dispose of the bodies by throwing them in the sea, the disease erupted. Though often repeated, the story was not based on eyewitness accounts. The only known source for it comes from the papers of a lawyer, Gabriel de Mussy, who worked near Genoa in the town of Piacenza. He claimed in turn to have heard the story from some sailors. Since the dead bodies could not breathe on their intended targets and spread the disease in the common manner, they would have needed to carry living fleas to infect the city. The story seems doubtful. Not because the Mongols were unwilling to spread the disease in that manner, but because it probably would not have been a strategy likely to succeed. With or without human intention, the disease was already spreading and would continue to do so. When the Genovese and other refugees fled the port by boat, they took the disease with them to Constantinople, from where it easily spread to Cairo in Egypt and to Messina in Sicily. If the city was the ideal home for the plague, the closed environment of the ship was the ideal incubator, a place where humans, rats, and fleas could mix intimately without the noxious presence of horses or fire, the two things that fleas most avoid. Freed from the comparatively slow movement on the trading route, where the disease had to wait for precisely the right cart or cargo of goods, the plague spread with the speed of the wind in the sails. In 1348, it ravaged the cities of Italy, and by June of that year, entered England. By the winter of 1350, the plague had crossed the North Atlantic from the Faroe Islands, on through Iceland, and reached Greenland. It may have killed 60% of the settlers of Iceland, and the plague was probably the single most important factor in the final extinction of the struggling Viking colony in Greenland. In the 60 years from 1340 until 1400, according to some estimates, the population of Africa declined from 80 million to 68 million inhabitants, and Asia